currently stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire, Maryland's 5/8 mile training track, completes the full-service facilities from the foaling barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
At the races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back a minute into hour three on this Tuesday as we continue to kind of savor the Preakness, and Chad Brown just joining us, and earlier Jose Ortiz and Tim Layden as well, Andy Serling of the New York Racing Association, and Andy there to enjoy Preakness as well. Andy, good morning.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
Terrific. Really good. We've had a really fun morning, and heard Preakness from and the early voting from Chad's perspective, Jose Ortiz as well. For you, how was your Saturday?
Good morning. Good morning. Wow. What a depressing way to end it, huh?
Well, no, I got somebody after you. I got the executive director of the Texas Racing Commission. So,
wow, I should probably hang up now.
No, you got to. I need you for 20. No, she's been on once before, Amy Cook. She's confronted the horse racing. The HISA organization, there's a real important conversation, I think, to be had about, you know, what her questions to Lisa Lazarus entail and how it's going to unfold, actually. So I'm intrigued. Yeah. But for you...
Wow.
Well, Chad, and I have, you know, I had not, I mean, Chad, we talk to regularly. The conversation with Jose, I don't think we've spoken since he won the Eclipse. So it's, what, 5 years? And he is really a complete, I don't even want to say young man. It really feels like he's, you know, a man in full, I guess, as they say. He talked about
he's a
family.
He's a good guy. He's a good guy. He's a smart guy, and he's an interesting guy. I agree.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of his. Yep, I agree. One of my favorite jockeys and riders out there speaks. People are on the track in general, yeah. No, he's very bright. He's very thoughtful.
I enjoyed that very much. If people missed it, catch it later or the replay tomorrow. Andy, for your part going into this, what were your thoughts? And then talk about how it unfolded on track.
Well, I mean, you know, I think he's a very talented horse who has an enormous amount of speed. And, you know, this is something that we talked about extensively when he won the Withers, a race that I feel like a lot of people didn't understand fully. And I feel like in retrospect, the opinion that, you know, I talked about with him was accurate. that he has the ability to go fast and still finish. And he's improved from a speed figure standpoint with every one of his starts. But I also think that he's a horse that a figure maker like Craig Mikowski sort of got right in ways that other people didn't, because he his cruising speed, his if you look at his pace based numbers, they were stronger than his final time numbers. And I think that in his particular case, that he was a very good horse to use pace based numbers with. And I think that's why some people were fooled by him. They didn't realize he was as good as he was, because his final time numbers were never that good. They got progressively better, but they hadn't been that good. And he, Chad got him to stalk without taking away his speed. And I think that worked out very well for him. And he's a very talented horse. And I'm not convinced that there isn't a realistic argument that right now he's the best 3-year-old out there. Got the highest figure anyone's gotten. Contrary to popular belief, that pace actually was fast. And he was right on top of it, and he ran extremely well. I understand that there's a lot of clamoring that poor Epicenter was much the best in the race, and, for way too many people, there's no argument against that. Well, there's always an argument for and against it. And I do understand that there's an argument for it, but the reality with Epicenter is I don't think he has the speed that he once had. I don't think he can't get it back. And I'm not saying that Steve won't get it back for him. But in teaching him to raise in Louisiana, which was a good thing, and then the same way he raised in Kentucky, and I don't want to hear the pace was so much faster, and he still was going, he still changed his style a bit. And it wasn't Joel Rosario taking him back, because he didn't. It wasn't Irad Ortiz cutting him off, because he didn't. It wasn't him breaking slowly, because he didn't. It was being out-quickened to spots. And because he was out-quickened to spots, he couldn't have that forward position that he's worked well for him in the past, three races back and before that. And one of the things that the talents that Joel Rosario possesses as a rider, that a lot of riders don't, is he doesn't panic. He sees a situation and he thinks, I need to do something to try to make the best of a bad situation. And doing that, he dropped him over, got him right the fence. The rail was absolutely a place to be. I'm not going to say it was a gold rail, but certainly was a good place to be on Saturday. And I don't think there's any denying that. And he got him there, and he saved all the ground. So the two things that happened were, one is that he didn't have the positional speed they hoped to have. Well, I'm not sure that was bad for him, because it was a quick pace. And you can say, well, other horses didn't make big runs. Well, Secret Oath did. She just got stayed a little bit more than he did early. And she made this preposterous, premature, wide move that she might have gotten away with in the Kentucky Oaks, but she wasn't getting away with in this field, because she's not as good as these horses. And he is much better than she is. And he just saved ground, and he was held up a bit about the half mile 7/16 pole. But he also cut the corner, saved all the ground, and he still ran the fastest figure, or equaled the fastest figure he'd ever run before. So to suggest that he has some sort of horrible trip and prevented him from running this race, where he apparently would have run, four or five lengths better than he'd ever run before, which I guess is possible, but seems unlikely, is to sort of not really think the whole thing through and just have a knee-jerk reaction about a heavy favorite who obviously many more people bet than any other horse in the race. And therefore, there's many more people out there that were annoyed after the race. And I get being frustrated by his trip. But I think if you take it into its entirety, the argument that he was the best horse in the race starts to fall apart. He had some bad things. It was not great to get that mediocre position early, but he wasn't that far out of it. And he was riding the rail, saving ground every inch of the way. He never left the rail, this horse. So I don't quite understand this, extreme argument that he was much the best. There's no argument against it. But anybody that says that ever is always on the wrong, because when you use those absolutes in these sort of vague trip to conversations, I think it's a good conversation. I think a bigger, better question is, and I think I'm sure that Steve is thinking of this, and you don't have the success that he's had, and forget about all the wins, to track the success he's had at the highest level in the game without understanding these things. And my guess is that when we see him again, he's going to be employing his speed much more. And I love that there's an argument about these two horses, because there's certainly a strong argument that they're the two, they're at least two of the five, if not two of the three or four, if not two of the two, best 3-year-olds out there right now. And to think of them renewing a rivalry that's created some heated debate between people is great. It's good for the game. And I like the argument. I find the absolutism apparently on one side to be sort of pitiful. But I think it's an interesting argument. But I don't think there's an absolute argument that he was the best horse. I think there's a very valid argument he was the second best horse. I think there's a reasonable argument by some people he was the better horse. I just don't agree with it.
Well, and I was going to try to weave in fact, Epicenter and early voting's, previous experiences on and near leads and you know, how their seasons evolved to meet in this spot. But one thing that what you just explained pops in my head even more so is the fascinating scenario that we've got Epicenter and early voting. We've got Zandon to fold into this as well, and Mo Donegal, horses that more from off the pace. I mean, everybody's been so caught up in who's not running in which Triple Crown race that they're kind of missing the fact that the second half of the year, these horses are all going to weave back together, and it's going to make for some very good confrontations. I like the way this whole thing is playing out.
I agree. Mo Donegal's got some explaining to do about his last race.
Lucy,
I'd like to see him do well, and I've always liked him, but I thought Derby was very mediocre, considering he was head-to-head with the winner, and I know the winner saved more ground than he did, but I don't know. I'm skeptical. Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Can you talk, and I put you on hold for 1 second. I'm sorry to do this, but I have to.
No, go ahead. No, I can guess very easily whose call's coming in, so let Andy take that. And because it gives me a chance to kind of fill out a little bit of what we just discussed earlier with Tim Layden, and I'm sure when Jay Privman joins us, I'll look forward to that.
Steve, I'm back. I'm sorry I had to take that.
No, not at all. Not at all. But I want people to appreciate, you're going to have the Belmont field that comes together as it is. Right now it's 10. But take the other horses that people are going to be looking forward to, as the year unfolds, that are going to be coming back. And that includes Taba and Messier and Cyberknife Zozos.
Taba's coming back? I'm not.
You said that. I know.
I think the unfortunate thing is that if they had worked back, and I don't blame the trainers for this at all, if the trainers had been allowed to work back from the Travers, I think he would be that monster looming out there in a way. I think the idea that we'll see him again in these major three-year-old races this year is far, far from certain. I hope he comes back, and I hope he can still run because he's very talented. But I think running that Derby may just be, screwed him up for a long time. I hope I'm wrong, but I've seen this too many times.
Isn't that the concern that Chad expressed about going ahead with early voting and running
of
him
course.
In the Derby at the long term expense of the horse?
Of course. If they had, taken Taba and they had found an allowance race, or whatever, maybe they'd gone to Lexington and then maybe used that to springboard the Preakness, things could have been different. But they chose a path that obviously had the bigger pot of gold in theory at the end of the rainbow, but potentially had much more dire consequences. And, the funny thing, that to me there's a great irony out there of this, what I consider irresponsible conversation about changing the Triple Crown. A lot of it based on an 80-to-1 shot being held out of the Preakness, and in my opinion, foolishly. But there have been three horses that I know of, sort of, that were legitimate Derby qualifiers over the last slightly over 20 years that were held out to await the Preakness. The obvious two are early voting and cloud computing for Chad Brown and Carvage. The other one is Red Bullet. He was owned by this guy. I think he got a tangential relationship to racing, Frank Stronach. And it's sort of interesting that you're hearing all this clucking about changing something that the only things that works in racing, we're managing to decide to ruin that too, because of, you know, some petty jealousies and some foolishness out there. The guy who owns the tracks now in Maryland did the same thing, and it worked. The more surprising thing is why more people don't see that the Derby is not necessarily the right race for their horse, but giving the horse two more weeks and, under the circumstances, pointing to the Preakness. These races are all important in their own right. The Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont. They're very important as a series, but they're also important in their own right. And the surprising thing is that more people haven't done what Frank did and what Klarovich did in waiting, despite the fact that these results have worked. Everybody just jumps forward into the deep water, right? And it's not necessarily the best thing for a lot of these horses. So maybe more people should look at it a little bit differently and realize that they can play this series differently and just change something that works. Because NBC is upset because they lost the Belmont to Fox, and to deny that that's playing into this is to, you know, not see the, you know, just not be able to see reality. And because an 8-1 shot didn't run the Preakness, this works. And the part of the reason it works is the short time span keeps people interested, keeps the enthusiasm alive. You spread these things out 4 or 5 weeks apart, and that enthusiasm dies. And you also badly mangle the rest of the calendar, with the Haskell and the Travers, et cetera. And beyond that, who's clamoring for this? The people on NBC, where it was inaccurately said that the Derby winner frequently passes on the Preakness? It happened in 85 with Spendabuck. Other ones were injury-related. So this is the first time since 85. It doesn't frequently happen, and it won't frequently happen. And I don't know what this clamor is to change something that isn't broken. And not just isn't broken, is the one thing that seems to work well in racing, that creates a lot of public interest, and has the potential for creating enormous public interest when there's a potential Triple Crown on the line. That will never happen if they expand the time period. Another instance, 100%. The goose that lays the golden eggs.
No, you hit on the two major arguments that just reinforce the value of it as it is, and you know, unintended consequences of fiddling, you know, in terms of and not understanding what it does in relation to the races that come later and the races that come earlier.
It's
just silly.
It's a narrative that's being created because of certain individuals and organizations, a couple of them in particular, one in particular, that has an axe to grind. And they're creating an issue that doesn't exist.
Period. I used the exact same terminology earlier with Tim Layden. Said the same thing. This isn't a problem. Why are we, you know, ring? You know, the funny thing is, if a horse stops in front of Sonny Leone a little bit more, and he ends up second, like commanding curve, nobody's got anything to say. You know, if Epicenter and Zandon are 1-2 and he's third, none of this is discussed. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And also, Andy, by the way, speaking of things that that were affected by Rich Strike's Derby win, what about that wagering on Saturday?
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising that these, you know, sort of no-hopers took more money than they should have, but it's surprising the extent to which it happened. I mean, the idea that, what's the three horses' name? Fenwick. I mean, it's a 1,000-to-1 shot. And, you know, contrary to what clearly some of these bettors thought, a random, almost inexplicable result in the Derby did not increase the chances of horses like Happy Jack and Fenwick to win the race. They essentially have no chance on paper. And they took a crazy amount of money, I agree. Crazy. I mean, Fenwick, 13-to-1 or something? He wasn't even the longest shot on the board. I mean, that's almost maniacally dumb. you know, over $1 million was spent on him.
It's inexplicable. I mean, and the fact that, that he and early voting were the same price at within an hour or whatever it was of the start. And I, you know, I actually was surprised at how much the lines, how much they moved. And maybe it's just because it's not as much money as we see in the pools at Derby and where the line, where they pretty much are pretty static. But I looked up at one point and I was like, that can't, I took a double take.
Yeah, no, I think all of us thought that maybe, you know, many of us thought that it was some sort of pool that had a very small amount of it. There was going to be a huge blast of money at the end that never came. And I don't know. It's really puzzling. And it's not surprising those words were overbet. It's just surprising the extent to which they were overbet.
Early voting to pay $13.40?
Well, especially if you made $13.40 in the face of the prices these other horses were. To think that Fenwick was a shorter price than Cloud Computing was when he won the Preakness. You know, you look at them in sort of in relative terms, and it's incredibly puzzling. It's almost as crazy as a huge uproar that we need to change the Triple Crown because Rich Strike didn't run the Preakness. But maybe it's the year of insanity, you know. Maybe it's the year of normally rational people, you know, achieving new levels of irrationality. Seems to be the decade for it. Or the century for it.
Or the millennium. Beyond Preakness, Andy, a couple of other spots that were notable.
I don't know under notable the undercard horses were. Well, you know, there was also this sort of complaining about the card in general. Well, in today's day and age, if you're offering that level of purses on a day like this, you're not going to get the kind of stars, you know, that you can get if you offer purses. So I'm not surprised. I mean, I enjoyed some of the races, but I don't think anybody was overly excited by what we saw. I mean, I tell you, I never saw the Black Eyed Susan. I probably should watch it. It was a sort of fun field of what this point or the second tier in that crop. Doesn't mean that some of them couldn't move forward. I did watch the end of the Pimlico Special. Was happy for people at West Point to get that big win with First Captain. We'll see what it means going forward. I imagine they'll probably be pointing him for a race like the Suburban after winning a mile 3/16. You know, and you go from there, and whether or not you think you can run the Whitney or the Gold Cup. But, you know, you pay that kind of money, and that kind of, you have, you know, they have to try to win a grade one with that horse. And I wish them the best of luck in doing it. But I didn't really, I mean, did you think there were any races on Saturday that were particularly memorable?
I would say, technical analysis win. You know what was interesting? You know what was funny, Andy, is how often we look at races and we think, okay, there's not a lot of pace here, and if there's not a lot of pace, we can bet against set piece, and then a pace turns up.
Well, I thought Atone would win that race, but Atone was awful. Forget about set piece winning. Atone was horrendous. It wasn't really the pace. I mean, he just was awful. He didn't run a step. I mean, he couldn't even keep up with lesser horses that were on the supposedly tough pace. I just think he was bad in set piece rank. I mean, I don't think that was a particularly, I mean, we're talking about set piece, who's basically and also ran when racing matters, right? He's been a horse at times, he's run some nice races, but he's never been able to step it up in the tougher races, right? Ethereal Road was so much better than those horses that his victory was hardly surprising. I think, you know, it pokes a hole in this incredible bias situation. You know, maybe it was more a one-turn situation. I don't know. It did seem hard to close during the day. I don't disagree with that. But then again, that race fell apart. And, I always feel that, you know, the better horses are able to mitigate biases at least a little bit. I don't think we're dealing with some sort of wild extreme bias, but maybe we were. I mean, to be honest, I didn't pay enough attention. I sort of went there and enjoyed myself during the day, and I didn't have any great ideas during the day, so I didn't bet much.
Well, two Friday performances that I can mention. It looks like I had Norm Cassie yesterday. How about Norm Cassie's Philly?
Yeah, that was probably and the performance of the weekend. I'm glad you brought that
that's
up.
That's what I said.
Yesterday. I mean, that was, I mean, that Philly was incredible. You know, did the help track help her a little? Maybe, but geez, I mean, she ran a 107 buyer. I did Norm, what's Norm thinking of, a race like the Delaware Handicap or something?
He's got the Fleur de Lis next.
Okay.
Out of her own stall.
Okay. Where presumably she'll meet Clairière.
Very possibly,
right.
Yeah.
Right, when you get the impression that the Philly, what's her name, that won, that's gotten the Pauline's Pearls, is going to Belmont and Clairière. I mean, they're going to keep them apart, so 101. I always thought that Clairière would be suited more toward, well, they're both suited Belmonts, they're both closers. That's the thing, you know. Belmont has been turned, the Belmont Stakes Day has been turned into an incredible day of racing in the event that the Belmont Stakes isn't this huge marquee race other than being the Belmont Stakes. There isn't a Triple Crown, there isn't these things. When you think about, what is there, 9 grade ones over the course of the weekend, starting with the New York on Friday, and, you know, the Met Mile at this point appears to be a matchup between Speaker's Corner and Flight Line. Last year's Breeders' Cup sprint winner, Aloha West, is pointing to it as well. The Ogden Phipps is Latruska, with Malathot and Search results meeting for the first time since Kentucky Oaks. And
nice.
One of Pauline Pearls and Clairière, both of whom look terrific this year. Pauline Pearls won against, you know, did not have a good trip and set up, and she still was able to win and run a more than credible race. You have those two races at the very least. I mean, obviously, I don't know really who's in Manhattan, but you have the Woody Stevens, which there are some nice horses out there, and Jack Christopher is being pointed to that race. And I'm leaving out your Just a Game. There's going to be some pretty tremendous races on that card. And if you want to have a memorable day of racing, you got to put up the money and run those kind of races. And, yeah, those are races that normally be spread out a little bit more. And so, yeah, it's going to have some of a deleterious effect on the rest of your month, but it's going to make that day into a day that's an incredible day of racing, even if the Belmont Stakes isn't the marquee event that it can be when you have a Triple Crown going or you have, you know, something extremely popular going on. So if you want to make these days important, you have to work to make them important. They just don't become important on their own necessarily.
Well put. Let me ask you about one winner that I don't know what Christophe Clément and Bobby Flay might have learned. What Pizza Bianca's win? It feels like she has not come forward at all from two.
I've said my piece about the mistake that I believe in people taking over match choices over the Royal Ascot. I think it's pretty clear how I feel about that. An owner has a right to do what they believe is right or want with their horses. They pay the bills. They pay the freight. They can do it. I don't understand what about her performances suggests that it's even remotely possible that she's going to be competitive in a race like the Coronation Cup, a race that can pit the winners of the, you know, the English Guineas, the Irish, the French. And in a lot of ways can be, you know, the toughest mile race on their turf in those situations. And I wish the best of luck. I do, but I just don't understand. And I think that while Ascot has done a very impressive job at convincing people, high-profile horses to participate in races where they're 4 and 5 times the price, conservatively, that they would be in important races in the U.S. It's impressive what they've done to sell this bag of goods to them. I just don't agree with it. But they've certainly done a lot to increase their profile on an international scale. I think it's happened at the expense of necessarily the best interests of some of these horses from a standpoint of races they can be successful in. But I don't own them. I don't pay the bills. They can do what they want. I just don't agree. And I can also disagree with it. And I choose to disagree with it. And I think it's been to the detriment of some of these horses over time. And the numbers stand up. There's a big difference between two-year-olds and sprinters. You know, there is no, it's been noted that the European sprinters on turf don't have a real advantage necessarily over us, Australia, the Far East. So I can understand. And I also understand that, like, Slipstream going over there for Christophe. What is he passing? The Paradise Creek at 7 furlongs? I get that. And he's in a race where he has a chance to at least be competitive. And we've seen the sprinters do well. I understood Tepin. Tepin had already done everything. What more did she need to do? So I can understand certain situations. I don't understand a three-year-old at this point in the year, especially when you have the races that we do in New York. Now, maybe they feel that under no circumstances is Pizza Bianca going to get the mile and a quarter of the Belmont Oaks or mile and 3/16 of the Saratoga Oaks. But they are $700,000 stakes, you know. One of them's a grade one. So they made their decision. I wouldn't have made it, but their horse. I love the races at Ascot. I think there's a misimpression. I don't like the Ascot race. It's great. I love European racing. I try to follow it to some extent. But that doesn't mean that I think running our horses over there makes sense. But you have to credit the Ascot selling this to the people. I mean, they've done it. And despite the results, people seem to like it. So I guess there's something to going over there and, you know, and losing. You know? And, you know, I guess it works for people. I just it wouldn't be my cup of tea, but can't ever to each their own, I guess.
Well, there's some stakes action for Memorial Day weekend to look ahead to. The Friday card is set, but Saturday, I think we got the Soaring Softly, and I think Paradise Creek, and then we got a New York Showcase Day on Monday.
Paradise Creek is Sunday, I think. Yeah, I mean, the NOMS
Sunday
for both races really look pretty interesting. So those races actually felt pretty good. I think that American Revolution is supposed to return the commentator, right?
Ooh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I think he is. And those are always fun days. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I enjoy being at Belmont. It's nice at Belmont. And one day the weather will even get nice. You know, it'll stop being in the 60s. Or 90s, depending on how you look at it. 60s or 90s. No, there's no middle ground.
No, right? Well, Andy, I know how much you enjoyed it and how much you enjoyed sharing that classic win, another one at Pimlico with Seth Klarman and with Chad and everybody. It was really, as Chad said a little bit ago, when you plan on something and you target something and you execute and it works, that's got to be, you know, a very satisfying feeling. And
well, I mean, racing is, you know, you can do the right thing in racing and lose, and you can do the wrong thing in racing and win.
Right.
Though it's less likely you'll do the latter, but you know it's not always. And I, you know, right and wrong. You make a decision that is best for you and your horse. It's, you know, it's another thing like Ascot. If people think it's best to go, they should go. But I mean, obviously, there is a lot. By the way, there is a lot of upside to going to Ascot. I realize, and things are expected value equations. I just don't think this one pans out mathematically. But yeah, I mean, it's the surprising thing is that more people don't take a more broad view of the situation. I mean, this notion of just being in the Derby, I don't know. It reminds me of years ago when Mark Cuban bought the Mavericks. He was spending really lavishly. And he was losing a bunch of money every year, like $40 million a year. And he said, there was some quote I read from him saying that he didn't care if he lost the money, he was just having so much fun, it was so great. And a friend of mine who has a lot of experience in owning a sports team said, I don't care who you are and how much money you have. Losing $40 million a year gets tiresome very fast. And within a year or two, Mark Cuban was having a fire sale of players and doing things to cut costs and run his business more efficiently. So, you know, sometimes what you think is the right idea isn't. And it's just a lot of people say, you just want to be in the Derby. I don't know. I want to be in the Derby with a horse that's a chance to win, and the Derby experience doesn't rate to be a bad one for them as well. And I think if more people took a more broader view of it, think it would also make the Derby a better race, and I also think it would make all the races better. But sometimes people are a little slow to come around. Some people.
Andy Serling, everybody, of the New York Racing Association. The action picks up on Friday, although there's TV Thursday, right?
Yeah, I mean, I bet you're excited for that 5-day, 30 Indiana Grand Churchill Downs show.
Absolutely.
I'll be out there. I'll be doing my part.
You're a giver, Andy. That's what we love about
you.
Yeah,
I know. I just keep on giving.
Andy Serling, everybody. Oh, he's the greatest. I didn't bring it up with him. I said it before he came on the air. That was, what he said to me. If you missed it earlier, what he said. He said, I'm getting all these texts from people. They see me on TV. They could see me on TV any day. It's not a novelty. they do have, because they've got the Twilight card on Thursday at Churchill, which came up with who? With Norm, I think, right? And they're going to show Indiana Grand. And in fact, tomorrow, we got Indiana Grand to catch up on. This is assuming that, there aren't tubes attached to me tomorrow morning. We didn't get to the opening day. I'll do it tomorrow. Opening day at Delaware. Certainly got to celebrate Del Park kicking off the season. Looks like they're going to have a nice meet. And we got to catch up on Indiana and Canterbury tomorrow as well. Right now, we're going to welcome in Amy Cook. She's the executive director of the Texas Racing Commission and sent a missive to Lisa Lazarus at HISA. And it could be a template to confront the new entity that may or may not supervise everything in racing. Amy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks so much for having me on your show. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, because people need to understand what the commission's concerns are, and you're involved in the HBPA suits that are challenging ICE's authority. What was your thought in asking these questions, and then tell everybody, what you want HISA to say to you and what answers you need?
Okay, thank you so much. I'm honored, as you mentioned, to be the executive director of the Texas Racing Commission. I've been in the position a short few months, so I was not involved in this industry when the bill was being sent through Congress. And, I come from a military background where we really believe in clarity, communications create partnerships create solutions. And so I think we can all agree in this community that uniform safety rules and standards, are important because the whole point of the Horse and Racing Integrity and Safety Act, from the beginning was to protect horses. Unfortunately, the law as designed, the methodology that it employs is not effective. And the unintended consequences of it, as you mentioned in your last interview, unintended consequences are really what's happening here. So in December, I wrote Governor Abbott a letter, and I essentially was concerned that the effect of the law on Texas was that the HISA authority was intending to replace my governor and my commissioners with itself. And that's a violation of the anti-commandeering aspect of the 10th Amendment. And so then, we wanted to partner, we wanted to communicate, so we went through the process. We provided 3 Federal Trade Commission comments, January, February, and March, and those are posted on our webpage. And then actually in February, as this dialogue got, more engaging with Ms. Lazarus coming on as the CEO, I sent her an invitation to visit us in Texas because I really felt like the issue was communication. And also because we weren't getting communication, and we knew that we would have agreements being sent to us and cost letters. What I know from my time serving both in the Army and the Army National Guard is that what gets resourced gets done. So really the question here in the protection of horses and the participants in racing is who's paying for it? I mean that's the big question. So in the National Guard, for example, the cost model that's employed there when you need the National Guard to answer a federal call is there's a cooperative agreement program. The federal government comes up with essentially 75% of the cost. The state applies for 25% of the cost. It's a match program, and the Guard is prepared to respond. So the same model would work here. And so in March, I proposed that model, and I called it There Is a Better Way, which also has been mentioned in our press release and some other things, that the Federal Trade Commission could simply become a granting agency, the state racing commissions, all of which are under-resourced, you know, to achieve these standards, but all of them want to achieve uniform standards, I believe. I don't believe I'm speaking out of turn there, could say what it would cost. We could apply for these match programs, and then the state racing commissions that have been doing this business for over 125 years could lead the way and be able to do that. But because there's been no communication and no one taking us up on partnership models, so what we face today, May 24th, is regulatory chaos. And so the letter is meant to advocate for the great participants in Texas horse racing, because let's take, for example, you got a field, right, on one night at a live racing event in Texas. The first field has all thoroughbreds in it. So HISA, essentially, we understand, would regulate that. The next field on that same night is a mixed meet, mixed, you know, field, quarter horse and thoroughbred.
Sure.
You know, maybe there's Arabians and paint. So who's regulating that? The next one is quarter horses only. So you have this regulatory chaos created by which races, which horses, which events that isn't answered. And so we need answers. And so because we're waiting, what we do know is what they won't do. They won't do the anti-doping and medication control. That's been delayed. They won't, you know, do the LASIK advisory committee study. They won't do. And in fact, in some of the news articles that have come out, because there's been really no direct communication, they've said, hey, here's the deal. State law applies until we get our act together. Well, that's unacceptable for the great state of Texas. We need clarity. We need leadership. And quite honestly, the background I have is leading teams and organizations and providing that clarity for the groups that I advocate for. And in this case, it's the regulatory body, it's the state of Texas, and it's those individuals and animals that would participate in the great sport here. So I hope that's a good kind of one over the world of where we stand today.
It's outstanding, and we'll see how many other jurisdictions take your lead. Specifically, and the most alarming part of this, I mean, it's one thing to, you know, let HISA know that their personnel will need Texas Racing Commission licensing. That's fine. That can be achieved. And getting an answer about the covering of the races, that's fine. Your note that lays out in point two that under the Texas Racing Act, no parimutuel wagering is permitted for live or simulcast export. Wagering for races our commission does not supervise. Is there a workaround, or if they claim to be the authority starting July 1st, are people going to be able to bet on races in Texas?
Well, and this is the really important part of what we're trying to communicate here, is that, you know, when the folks in Texas have asked me, what are you going to do on the 1st of July, Amy? I said, I'm going to do the job. We're going to do the job, because we don't have any communication that HISA is prepared to do theirs, and we don't want to impair, you know, the ability of the business owners, the participants in racing, to be able to conduct their business. We have scheduled races, live races, through the end of this year. At a minimum, tell us what your intention is, HISA, because we need to know, because it's absolutely unfair for the participants in racing in the state not to know when HISA expects to show up. Because here's the reason I threw licensing in there. If you show up at a racetrack, you can't get in unless you're licensed by us. But under the Texas Racing Act, and I think this is the issue that you've kind of seen in the news articles lately. You know, there's a, will you opt in to pay fees for HISA, collect fees for HISA? Will you opt into agreement? Our statute in our state does not allow us to even make the opt-in choice. Our statute does not allow us to decide when we will and will not, you know, allow parimutuel wagering. If we do not supervise any aspect of racing, there will be no pari-mutuel wagering. Our commission's chair made that abundantly clear. Our statute does not allow it to go on in the state of Texas if we do not supervise. And that's a huge economic loss to the great state of Texas. And also, it's just the uncertainty that it creates for businesses and participants, as well as kind of a regulatory chaotic, you know, feeling about the whole thing is why I stepped out and said, you need to tell us what your intentions are here, because it's unfair, you know, to our folks for you not to have communicated that clearly.
General Amy Cook is our guest. She's the executive director of the Texas Racing Commission, and is essentially, I don't want to be confrontational about it, Amy, and say that you're challenging HISA, but you're asking for very reasonable, very reasonable questions. What are the potential outcomes that you're prepared to respond to?
Well, as you know, we are challenging them in court. You mentioned that at the beginning of the introduction. We are challenging the policy because, you know, the law requires HISA to implement it on 1 July, and they're not prepared to do that in apparently every communication that they've had in the public media, but they haven't directly communicated with us on their intentions, so they're not prepared to implement it. So the outcome, I think, is the great state of Texas. We strive here at the Texas Racing Commission to not only be the best state agency in Texas, but the most professional racing commission in America. And if you watch our last commission meeting, which is found online on our website, you will find me saying we can exceed those national standards that HISA is achieving for in Texas and actually be a leader in the horse racing industry. We don't need anyone to tell us how to do this. We can do it, you know, in partnership with them, or we can do it better than them because we lead the way in this great state. And the outcome will be that, you know, we'll be the model of how you should lead a racing commission and how you should lead a horse racing industry, hopefully in the country.
Well, and you know, it is notable. We should actually give some credit to what has transpired overall. I mean, I talk most often, Amy, about what's happened at the venues, at Lone Star and Sam Houston, where the funding mechanism, the interesting tax usage that essentially set money into purse accounts at the Texas racetracks really bolstered, you know, you're sitting there surrounded, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana, you're surrounded by gaming states, and it really has gone a long way to stabilizing Texas racing, not even just stabilizing, but actually, you know, really raising the quality of it and the focus of owners and horsemen. But in addition, you know, the commission itself was basically like a goldfish out of the bowl a couple of years ago, right? You're born again hard, Amy, as they say.
Well, and yeah, absolutely. Our legislature almost dissolved the last July, and in their wisdom, they decided to name a new chair of the commission, Judge Robert Pate, and he went out on a search for a new executive director, and I happened to be retiring from the military right around the same time, and I applied for the position, and he selected me. And he asked me to take the agency in a completely new direction. And I think that type of leadership and background experience that I've had, when we're talking about cooperative agreement programs or partnerships, no, I'm not of this community, but I am absolutely for this community. And so just because you've never heard of a cooperative agreement program, if you read our FTC comment dated March 4th, 2022, there's three steps to take. And I'm prepared. I told the Association of Racing Commissioners International I would give them a presentation. I'll talk to anybody about this because my goal is to protect those who cannot speak for themselves, those horses, and anyone who would like to enter in the sport. I mean, really, while all this back and forth is going on, those that can't speak for themselves are really the losers here. And that would be unfortunate that we can't overcome all this back and forth and just work together and get it done.
How much progress do you think could be made? You mentioned that you've invited HISA and Lisa Lazarus. How much do you think could be achieved with some dialogue?
Oh, absolutely. So I think that, that probably the legislation as written, I mean, there's challenges there because it did not go through the normal legislative process. I think that that aside, the Federal Trade Commission, with our help, with all the state racing commissions, could identify what the cost would be, could come together because there are uniform standard safety rules out there that could be adopted if we collaborated and worked together. I would say within the next year, we could actually come up with a way to establish this grant program, ask Congress for an appropriation, and get this thing going. I mean, it's worked for the Guard for over 100 years. It works in public safety program. It works in homeland security programs. It works in every industry I can think of. The federal government has a grant program. The states apply for it to achieve those. The states can audit. They can check. They can make sure that we are achieving that national standard, and there's no reason why it wouldn't work here. It's just a matter of lack of understanding, and I'm willing to talk to anyone to explain it and to help it and write whatever it takes, legislation, grant proposals, whatever it takes to make this happen, because I'm all in. I'm invested in the future of horse racing, that it's a safe sport and it's done with integrity and credibility, and it's something we're all proud of.
Well, and what's interesting about this is that your perspective, which actually is very fresh. I mean, you've got a legal background, and then you talk about your military experience, but your immersion into, you know, equine sport and the the rather convoluted mechanisms that you know that police it and manage it. You're essentially agreeing that the concept it absolutely is vital and viable, but you just don't feel like this is being executed in a practical manner.
Correct. And it would be like Travis at the Alamo standing there by himself and saying, hey, who's going to cross this line with me? And everybody standing on the other side going, we want to cross the line. We want to cross the line with you. But here's the problem. You're not talking to us. You're not listening to us. You're not explaining, you know, what you're trying to do here. You're not letting us help you because we actually have the institutional experience in the state racing commissions to form a united federal regulatory body, you know, if that be the right model. But to do it without us is perilous. And so we can do it together, or we can do it without each other. And it would be unfortunate if it went that way. But if that is the way it goes, then Texas is prepared to lead the nation in being the best racing commission, most professional racing commission in America.
Well, those that haven't, I'll put a link up. And actually, Amy, when you mentioned your comments in the FTC when the rules were submitted. The website that you're citing, it's just the txrc.texas.gov?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay, all right. I'll send out links, and I want people to see the letter and to understand the ramifications here. That, I mean, there's a real chance that if the answers aren't provided and there isn't some, you know, some potential agreement, does this, in your mind, does this lay the groundwork for potentially asking for some legal recourse in the short term, an injunction perhaps?
Well, that is actually the purpose of the lawsuit that we intervened in, that is now on a surface, is a preliminary injunction. Because the whole point of that would be to declare that the law as currently written is unconstitutional, which would send it back to Congress for a rewrite and provide the opportunity for the Federal Trade Commission to, one, become a grantor, two, to ask the state racing commissions what the resourcing looks like, and three, for us to apply for those grants and make this thing happen together, which is what's in the March 4th FTC comment. And all of that is posted on our news page on Texas Racing Commission website.
Excellent. And I have not seen that, so I'm anxious to see it. But I don't want people to think, you know, industry stakeholders and horse players, particularly, Amy, are I don't want to say exasperated, but they're hopeful that this could be a path forward. And you actually, by challenging it, are not trying to dismantle. You're trying to have this kind of reworked so it's executed properly, so that the underpinnings and the foundation and everything that's built around it actually will work and meet the requirements of all the jurisdictions involved.
Right. So, you know, military, right? So the mission is protect the horses and never have, you know, the shadow cast on the horse racing industry again, and protect, you know, the integrity of the sport. The way the mission is being executed is flawed. The mission is possible. There is hope, but it takes everyone coming together to do it together. It can't be done independent of the state racing commissions, of the industry stakeholders, of the citizens of the states or the United States of America. You can't stand there by yourself and have it go well. We're prepared to help you, to help everyone, but you have to go about this in the right way. And as I said when we started, you know, communication is where it starts. Communicate what's happening here. Communication creates partnerships, and partnerships create solutions, and that's what I'm suggesting here. And I'll, you know, use any means of communication to get my message through that there is a better way. And I'm hopeful that potentially this got, and I appreciate being interviewed, and I appreciate you bringing some attention to this, because it is not about me. It's about the sport. It's about those horses. And it's about really saying there is an alternative if everyone would just take a moment to consider it.
This has been quite something, and if we want to put it in military terms, racing may have its own Zelensky here to rally behind. Amy Cook, thank you so much.
Thank you. Talk to you anytime. Love to do that. Appreciate you so much.
Not at all. We will absolutely stay abreast and stay in contact. And as this unfolds, because we'll be anxious to see what HISA, their response, and what the next steps are. We've been following it all the way. That was tremendous. Amy Cook, the executive director of the Texas Racing Commission, joining us. Just about to pull up and send you out into the race day, and it is a Tuesday, so you know we got most of our Tuesday type opportunities. And now that it's summer, you got a little bit more. And as you know, as Delaware gets going, you're going to have tomorrow, and you'll have even more. But let's see today. Back in Indiana, I did tell you about the Presque Isle Stake, but I didn't get a chance to go through what went on at Horseshoe. We'll do that tomorrow with John Dooley. Belterra today as well, of course. And how about Fairmont, FanDuel Racing, Finger Lakes, back for the Tuesday card, Louisiana Downs, Mountaineer, Parks, Presque Isle. Now, don't forget, Presque Isle now, afternoons, Thistledown, and Will Rogers. There's your opportunities around the country. I want to thank Amy Cook. That was eye-opening. Amy Cook of the Texas Racing Commission, Andy Serling of the New York Racing Association, Chad Brown of Chad Brown Racing, Tim Layden of NBC Sports, Jose Ortiz, and Mike Trombetta. Good luck today if you're playing, everybody. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9. If you missed anything here on Sirius XM, I expect to be with you, but if not, you'll hear a best of. And good luck. Talk to you either tomorrow or very soon.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions, and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo STEVE200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Belmont Stakes returns to Belmont Park Saturday, June 11th. Tickets to the top of the stretch, the premier trackside picnic area with personal grills are almost sold out. Tickets to the test of the champion are on sale at BelmontStakes.com. Hurry before it's gone.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.